All right, so you've brought us a fascinating piece today, and I have to say, it's one that's both captivating and, well, a little unsettling. We're diving into Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights.
It's certainly a work that's captured imaginations for centuries.
Yeah, and sparked a lot of debate, too. I mean, some of the stuff in there, it's just wild. So where do we even begin with a painting like this?
Well, even now, it's kind of amazing how much we don't know about Bosch himself. You know, no diaries, no letters, really no firsthand accounts to give us a clear picture of the guy behind the brush.
So how do we even begin to interpret a painting like this, especially one with such, let's just say, unique imagery?
Right, right. And that's part of what makes it so endlessly fascinating to unpack, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But we do have some things to go on, like it's a triptych, right? Three panels hinged together, that's got to tell us something.
Exactly. And triptychs, especially back then, were often used for altarpieces. So there's this immediate connection to religion.
Ah, okay. So even if the images are weird, the format itself has some traditional meaning.
Exactly. So imagine it closed. What you get is this scene, and it's surprisingly muted, almost entirely these green-gray tones. It's the world during creation.
Oh, wow. Like seeing the world before color existed, almost primal.
And up in the corner, there's God. But he's tiny, almost getting lost in this vastness.
It's like the painting starts with this almost minimalist scene. You don't get the wild stuff right away.
You really don't.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we open the triptychs, and that's where the story unfolds. The left panel takes us to, you guessed it, the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, and it seems peaceful enough at first.
Idyllic, but like you said, there are these hints, right? These little details that make you go, wait a minute.
Totally. Like that dragon tree right in the center.
Yeah.
That's not just any tree. It's a symbol of eternal life.
Even in paradise, that carries some weight. Is it a promise? A threat?
Exactly. And then there are the animals.
Oh, yeah, the animals. A giraffe. An elephant with a monkey just chilling on its back.
Things that would have seemed unbelievable back in Bosch's day.
These were like creatures from travelogues, stories of far-off lands. Most folks would have only heard rumors.
Exactly. And this is where we start to see Bosch's world coming into focus, right? He's living through this time of massive change. The Renaissance old ideas are being challenged, and the world is literally expanding.
New discoveries coming in from all over.
And it's challenging what people thought they knew about the natural world.
So those exotic animals, they weren't just him showing off, were they?
Not at all.
Yeah.
It was a way to bring these far-off concepts into his art.
A visual representation of this new world view.
Yes. Full of wonder, possibility, but also uncertainty. Maybe even some fear of the unknown.
It's like he's saying even paradise isn't as simple as we thought, right?
Exactly. And then we get to the central panel, the Garden of Earthly Delights itself, and whoa, this is where things get really
out there.
That's one way to put it. You've got all nudes, giant fruit, creatures that seem straight out of a dream.
Yeah, it's a visual feast, but what's the message? What are we supposed to make of it all?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? It's what makes this painting so debated. One interpretation, a popular one, is that it's a warning.
A warning. Like, hey, this pleasure stuff, look where it leads.
Precisely. The left panel, Paradise Lost. The center, well, that's indulgence. And then, of course, you've got the right panel.
Which is definitely not a party.
Not unless you like fire and torment, no. It's hell, plain and simple.
So it is a sinner's downfall story, then.
It's definitely a possibility. Would have resonated with people back then, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always a but with Bosch, isn't there?
Okay, there's more to it.
Right. Some scholars, they see that central panel differently. Not sin, but a kind of pre-fall utopia.
Before Adam and Eve, you mean, like before things went south.
Exactly. Humanity at one with nature, no guilt, no shame, that kind of thing.
Huh. And those giant strawberries and cherries, they play into that, don't they?
Exactly. It wasn't just Bosch being playful. They were symbols, sure, of pleasure, but also abundance, even innocence.
And this is where those Adamites come in, right?
Yes. The Adamites. Quite the group. Now, we don't know if Bosch was one himself, but
their ideas were floating around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they believed in this return to Eden, rejecting, well, a lot of societal norms, let's say.
So are we supposed to choose sin or utopia?
Maybe it's not about choosing. Maybe it's about the fact that we contain both, that duality.
He makes you think.
That's the point. No easy answers with Bosch. He gives you these striking images, these strange juxtapositions, and it forces you to grapple with them. Your own morality, your own desires.
He's like he's holding a mirror up to humanity.
And nobody wants to look too closely at those, do they? At least not all at once. But that's what makes it powerful, you know? 500 years later, and we're still talking about it, still trying to figure it out.
It's like he's giving us this puzzle with no solution, right? We get to try on different interpretations and see what fits. But he wasn't making art in a vacuum, was he? I mean, were there other artists who he influenced or who influenced him?
Yeah, that's such a great point to bring up because art history, it's not a straight line, is it? It's more like,
a messy family tree.
A messy family tree. And you can definitely see Bosch's fingerprints on the work of artists who came after him. One that immediately springs to mind. Peter Bruegel the Elder.
Oh, Bruegel. Now, there's another artist who knew how to paint the strange and wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. He was working about a generation after Bosch. And man, you can see those echoes, especially in those fantastical creatures Bruegel loved to paint.
Right. And those chaotic scenes he was known for. Like, what's that one? Mad Meg.
Oh, yeah. Mad Meg is a classic example. It's like he took that energy, that social commentary we see in Garden of Earthly Delights, and turned it up to 11. You've got this peasant woman, right? But she's leading this army of women to, you guessed it, raid hell.
I mean, if that's not Boschian, I don't know what is. And Bruegel wasn't afraid to get a little weird either, just like Bosch.
No, he wasn't. And that's the thing, right? They both use these wild, fantastical images, but underneath, there's this sharp commentary on society, on human nature, the good, the bad, the ugly.
And The Triumph of Death by Bruegel, that one's got a similar vibe, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Skeletons, fire, people running around like they've lost their minds. You could practically see the influence of that right panel of Garden of Earthly Delights in it.
It's like they were having this conversation, these two artists, but through their art. Using those same themes of chaos and moral reckoning.
Exactly. It's like Bosch provided this whole visual language for these dark, complex ideas. And then Bruegel, he picked it up and he ran with it. But it didn't stop there, did it?
Yeah.
I mean, Bosch's influence, it pops up in some surprising places.
You're telling me 500 years later and we're still talking about him. But you think someone like, say, the Surrealists, they were into this kind of thing too, right?
Oh, 100%. Those guys, Dali, Miro, they loved the strange and the subconscious, dreams, hallucinations, all the stuff Bosch was digging into centuries before.
Like in that Miro painting, the tilled field, with all the floating shapes and whatnot.
Exactly. It's like Miro took those elements of Bosch, the fantasy, the absurdity, and just ran with it, creating this dream world that's both playful and a little unsettling.
Very Bosch-like. And Dali too, right? I mean, melting clocks, weird juxtapositions. He was all about bending reality, just like Bosch.
Oh, yeah. Dali himself actually said Bosch was a huge influence. He even called him, get this, the first modern painter.
High praise. So what is it about Bosch, about this garden, that keeps artists coming back for more? What do you think?
It's his imagination, pure and simple. The way he built this world that's familiar and strange all at once. Beautiful and grotesque. You're drawn in, but there's this edge to it, you know? And those questions he asks about our desires, our morals, what makes us human, those never really go away, do they?
He was tapping into something timeless, something universal.
That's it. And the fact that there's no one right answer to this painting, the mystery of it all, it keeps us engaged. It's like a mirror, right? But instead of reflecting back just us, it reflects back all the possibilities, all the darkness, all the beauty, all mixed up together.
It's a painting that stays with you, makes you think.
And that's what art should do, right? Challenge us.
Yeah.
Make us see the world and ourselves in a new light.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, we have a little challenge for you. Go look at the painting again, maybe for the first time, maybe for the 10th, and ask yourself, what do you see? What secrets is it whispering to you? Because with Bosch, the conversation never really ends, does it? It just keeps going, drawing us deeper into the mystery and wonder of art. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and we'll see you in the next deep dive.